This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now open in Portland at 3646 Southeast Hawthorne and in Vancouver at 16501 Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. Also on the web at PEETS.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the grand jury hearing on the police beating death of James Chassie was held today. Fallout from the Mark Foley scandal is undermining Bush administration's credibility, even among conservatives. And legal challenges have been filed against Congress's elimination of habeas corpus.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,726 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 48,343 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website InformationClearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate may be as high as a quarter million dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2006. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. A Salem-based group has filed a federal lawsuit against the state of Oregon, alleging that voters have been constrained by a 2005 law which makes it tougher for independent candidates to qualify for the ballot. The law prohibits anyone who votes in a partisan primary election from helping to nominate an independent candidate. Before the law was enacted, any registered voter could sign a nominating petition for an independent candidate or attend a nominating convention. The lawsuit was filed by the Committee for Petition Rights, headed by legislative consultant Greg Wasson. No hearing has yet been set. Concerns about Oregon's nomination process surfaced in 2004 when Green Party member Ralph Nader tried to get on the state ballot as an independent candidate for president.
A grand jury hearing for the fatal police beating of Portlander James Chassie Jr. was held today. KBOO's Mike Monkfold was there.
A grand jury was convened today to investigate the death of James Chassie Jr. in police custody on September 17th. Chassie, who suffered from mental illness, died as a result of blunt force trauma to the chest sustained during a struggle with police, according to the state medical examiner. Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, a grassroots citizen organization, says that it, quote, seems reasonable, end quote, that the jury could return an indictment of criminally negligent homicide against the officers who fought with Chassie.
In this case, what's happened is the officers kicked Mr. Chassie in the chest and the head, according to the witnesses, and tasered him multiple times, all of which could have led to his death. And once they had done all that and he passed out and a paramedic had to come and revive him, they hogtied him and apparently, according to the photos that we've seen, left him face down on the sidewalk, which also could have led to his death. So since the police should have had that knowledge that those actions could have caused his death, they could, I think, be indicted for criminally negligent homicide in this case.
Portland Cop Watch sent a letter to Multnomah County District Attorney Michael Schrunk urging a thorough investigation of Chassie's death. Handelman says that such an investigation should be performed without bias.
Well, we want it to be thorough and fair in the sense that if one citizen beat upon somebody else the way that the police beat on Mr. Chassie and kicked him in the head and the chest and tasered him multiple times, I think that the district attorney would take it a little bit more seriously than they do when it's a police officer. So I think that he shouldn't go easy on them just because they're police officers.
Handelman said that bias toward police had been a problem before with the Multnomah District Attorney's Office in investigations of this nature.
We're calling for a thorough presentation of the facts to the grand jury because the only person who can speak to the grand jury is the district attorney. And since he works with the police every day, he's more likely to go easy on them and not necessarily give the jury all the facts they need. an example is with James Jahar Perez's death that happened in 2004, where he presented to the grand jury, including hiring a so-called expert from out of town who explained to the jury that sometimes officers have to pull their guns out really quick and shoot somebody if they think that the person has a gun. People who have were interviewed about that who are in the legal community were quite surprised. They'd never heard of an expert witness being hired to speak to a grand jury. And it seems like the only reason you would do that would be to keep the grand jury from issuing a criminal indictment.
Neither the Portland Police Department nor Chaussee family attorney Tom Steenson responded to requests for an interview for this story. The jury has yet to determine whether there is enough evidence for a trial. Chaussee's family, meanwhile, held a press conference today asking for public assistance in investigating his death. I'm Mike Monkvold, KBOO News.
A little-used Citizens Police Oversight Commission has come under fire in Spokane, Washington. This for holding its meetings behind closed doors. The Citizen Review Commission, which hasn't met for a decade, went into executive session last month to discuss a resident's complaint about a police lieutenant's off-duty conduct. The appointed city panel posted notice that it plans to meet behind closed doors again today. A lawyer representing the Spokesman Review contends the commissioner's decision to close its first meeting violated the state's Open Public Meetings Act. But Mayor Dennis Heshen says city lawyers have not told him the meetings violate state laws. The officer already has received a one-day unpaid suspension for using obscene language when a neighbor pulled a gun on her children and their friends over a vandalism incident. The appointed commission was established in 1995, but had not met in more than a decade. It has no staff or budget, lacks subpoena power, and reviews only complaints forwarded by the chief of police.
Vancouver authorities say a police officer fatally shot a transient who was camping behind a Walmart store. The officer says he shot the man because a toy gun the man pointed at him and refused to drop looked real. 64-year-old Douglas Damon was shot to death Sunday after residents near the store complained to police about homeless people in the area. Acting Police Chief Mitchell Barker says Detective Greg Raker was apparently justified in the shooting. The nine-year veteran fired the fatal shot while working overtime on patrol. He remains on paid leave. Baker calls Raker an exemplary officer.
Everett, Washington police are working with federal agents to investigate three small explosions over the weekend in North Everett. Sergeant Boyd Bryant says police have not been able to confirm that the explosions were related. No one was seriously injured and no property was significantly damaged. The first explosion happened in a parking lot on Saturday afternoon. Officers found fragments of a small pipe. A second explosion occurred around 7 p.m. Saturday in another parking lot, and officers again found fragments of a pipe bomb. Then, about 20 minutes later, a third explosion sounded outside the National Guard Armory. Bryant says the third device appeared to be smaller than the first two. He says all three were crudely constructed and didn't appear to be aimed at anyone in particular.
The Oregon National Guard will send 35 more volunteer soldiers and airmen to staff U.S. Customs and Border Protection in four southern border states. Under what is being called Operation Jumpstart, the federal government has sought volunteers to help with surveillance, civil engineering projects, administrative support, and training along the border with Mexico. Officials said none will take part in law enforcement activities. The deployment of Oregon Guard personnel for Border Patrol duty was made under an agreement between Governor Kulongowski and the U.S. Department of Defense. The agreement provides that guardsmen and women who volunteer for service on the Mexico-U.S. border may do so, but it gives the governor authority to recall the personnel if any emergency occurs in Oregon.
Vandals, who may have had master keys, caused as much as $500,000 in damage to a Medford Logging Company's equipment. This, according to Steve Avgeris, one of the owners of the company, Hilltop Logging. But authorities say that despite the initials of the Earth Liberation Front scrawled on some machines, they don't believe it was so-called eco-terrorists at work. Detectives at the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office in California say they don't have any reason to be looking in that direction right now. They say it's not consistent with similar cases in the past. Avgeris says his employees arrived at work yesterday to find dirt and debris in fuel tanks, severed hoses, lines and belts, and computer equipment ripped from log loaders. Nine pieces of equipment were damaged.
A Clackamas area woman has been arrested after the car she was driving struck and killed a bicyclist on Highway 99 East near McLaughlin Boulevard, south of Milwaukee. It happened last night at about 9:30 p.m. Police say a 2002 four-door sedan driven by Jennifer Ballou was northbound on Highway 99E near Southeast Silverleaf Lane. The car struck bicyclist Daniel Frank, who was also traveling northbound in the bicycle lane. He died at the scene. Police say it was Frank's 26th birthday. Ballou was uninjured. She was taken into custody on one count of manslaughter and lodged in the Clackamas County Jail. Alcohol and prescription medication are being investigated as possible contributing factors.
Last week, World Watch Institute Director Christopher Flavin spoke in Portland. His talk was called American Energy, Breaking Our Addiction to Oil. Amy Merwin reports.
We were contacted by the World Watch Institute about co-sponsoring an event, and it's in coordination with the release of Christopher Flavin's new paper called American Energy, Breaking Our Addiction to Oil. It's talking about the growing dependence on oil, that this is our country's Achilles heel, and it's undermining both the economy, threatening our security, and damaging the environment. Christopher has been a longtime critic of the U.S. energy policy and the failures of several presidents and congresses to develop any sort of alternatives to dependence on fossil fuel. This paper is a strategy for improving energy efficiency, developing renewable fuels, and building cooperative alliances with countries all around the world. What Christopher's likely going to be talking to us about is that this is the current crisis, and energy is the issue right now for us to be able to capitalize on, and the timing is just perfect for us to be able to permanently kick our dependence on oil.
I read an op-ed by Lester Brown, the founder of the World Watch Institute, and I believe the director for many, many years, and he was cautioning against total dependency on biofuels because they are already beginning to impinge on how the food crops throughout the world are being used. In other words, corn and sugar and others are going into fuel production rather than feeding people. And he recommended that raising the CAFE standards, the miles per gallon and the energy efficiency of vehicles is a primary focus also.
And I would have to agree that biofuels is one of the stair steps that gets us to a larger goal. Obviously, having higher CAFE standards and having more efficient vehicles and having clean cars out on the road is of paramount importance, because shifting away from one oil-related product to another, you're just not going to get the solution. This is a real good opportunity for rural communities to be able to participate. If we can shift over to those rural communities and reinvest some of the money that's already being used for fuel, that would certainly boost the production of biofuels. It's one step on a larger greenhouse gas and global warming type of solution.
The overall energy picture is going to be dependent on renewables, yet there's such a small share of the market, and people do not seem convinced that renewables can actually meet the energy needs for the future. I feel personally encouraged by the idea of tidal power and solar, because they're perpetual motion machines all in themselves. If we can figure out clean ways to tap that power, is there recommendations coming out of the World Watch Institute as to the directions that we go to provide all of our energy needs? Because in addition to biofuels for vehicles, we can certainly be using electric vehicles and hybrids.
Yes, I would agree with those. There's probably two separate issues there. One is the use of renewable power in our homes and businesses that feed into the larger electricity grid, and those definitely need to be incentivized as well. And renewable portfolio standards and that type of thing deserve a lot more attention. But on the biofuel side or on renewable fuel side, they do have several different policy recommendations, I believe, that they're going to be coming forward with in the market, that biofuel policy should focus on some market development and creating and enabling an environment based on sound fiscal policy. Private investment. Yesterday on the news, I saw that Richard Branson was going to be giving about $3 billion for renewable fuels, and venture capitalists around the entire world are actually moving more and more towards giving their money towards helping to speed the transition to the next generation technologies. And they'll be talking a little bit about encouraging broad rural economic benefits, sustainable international biofuel trades. Certainly efficiency and improved public transportation will be one that he will be hitting on as well. So it's going to take several different types of policy recommendations, not only in Oregon, but in the national level and international levels, to be able to get us to where we would like to be.
This is Amy Merwin.
And now an unusual story out of Washington State. Mara Moses, age 95, died last week, and her knowledge of Lushootseed language died with her. Her son, Ray Moses, says she was the last native speaker of the language on the Tulalip Indian Reservation. Linguists had spent years talking with Maria to preserve the language. The tribal chairman, Stan Jones, says she was the last person who really knew the Indian language completely. Moses was born in a barn on the reservation in 1911. She gave birth to 11 children and struggled to care for them. In the 1960s, Moses became the first woman to own and operate a commercial fishing boat out of Tulalip Bay. She employed her six daughters as her crew.
The world can't wait. That's the name of a national protest which hopes to force George W. Bush out of office, scheduled for Thursday. KBOO's Stephanie Potter spoke with organizer Jim Oberg.
But what we've recognized is that we're in a situation in this country now where things are happening that literally are scaring the pants off of most of us. And I think we're coming to a time when many of us realize that something has to be done. I have spent quite a bit of time looking at the situation with our elections around the country, and I believe very strongly that we have no way to stop what's going on in our country through elections. Diebold and other kinds of things have stopped that. So what World Can't Wait is saying is that it's time to get on the streets. It's time to vote with our feet. It's time to actually come out and take the anger that we have over what's happened to our country and express it with our neighbors and our friends, and begin to mobilize in a way where we can, in a cooperative manner, begin to let people know that we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And that's what building this movement of millions of people is out to do in America, is to say that we're fed up, we're not going to take it any longer, and we're going to do whatever we can to change the direction of our country. For Portland, we hope that out of this meeting we'll encounter many, many people who've raised that same question that I have. What can I do? You know, what can I do to make a difference in the face of what's happening in our country? And that they'll dare to come out and work with us in our various planning meetings that we have. There will be a planning meeting probably on the 22nd of October that we'll invite all the people who come to come and take part in. And then we'll start strategizing about how all of us working together can actually begin to make a difference here in Portland, just like the whole movement across the country is building to that same question. How can we make a difference in terms of stopping what's going on? It isn't through protests. We know that. But protests bring people out so that we can meet them and we can begin to organize them and we can begin to work together on a cooperative basis to really deal with the problems we face in this country. We like people in other countries who've done the very same thing can make changes in this country. Where it will lead to, we're not sure. Perhaps it leads to a reform of the Democratic Party. Perhaps it leads to the formation of a new party. Perhaps it leads to something that we can't even imagine right now. But we'll have a voice in that if we dare to work together and come together and do whatever we can to stop the direction that this country is going. I just want to say that we've scheduled this on a weekday, which is kind of unusual considering that people are working. But what we recognize is that down the road, as this thing builds, we are going to have to be willing to take off work and leave our schools and disrupt the kind of normal life that we have if we want to stop this. So I would call on you to take a day off from work. Come down, find out what's happening, see how you can help. Come out on October 5th at noon in the South Park Locks at Park and Salmon and join with us. Listen to the many speakers. We have Tom Hartman. We have a bunch of other people from different sectors who have things to say about why they believe it's so important that we need to drive out this regime. But most importantly, we want you to come out and meet those of us who are working to organize this, to figure out how you might join in and how you might contribute to what this whole movement across America is trying to do. We're looking forward to welcoming you, we're looking forward to educating you, and we're looking forward to working with you.
The World Can't Wait demonstration again is this Thursday, October 5th, at the South Park Blocks at Southwest Park and Salmon Streets at noon. For more information, go to www.worldcantwaitpdx.org.
Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld and former Attorney General John Ashcroft received CIA briefings about a possible al-Qaeda strike 2 months before the September 11th attacks. The State Department disclosed yesterday that the pair was briefed within a week of Condoleezza Rice, all of whom had previously denied advance warnings of the attacks, raising serious questions about the Bush administration's competence. One official who helped to prepare the briefing, which included a PowerPoint presentation, described it as a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 that connected the dots in earlier intelligence reports. Observers say the report presented a stark warning that al-Qaeda, which had already killed Americans in Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and East Africa, was poised to strike again. Former CIA Director George Tenet gave the independent September 11, 2001 commission the same briefing in January of 2004, but the commission made no mention of the warning in its 428-page final report.
President Bush and Vice President Cheney spent yesterday and today campaigning for Republican House candidates. But Republicans could lose major ground as the Mark Foley sexual harassment scandal has outraged conservative groups. FSRN's Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill.
Although President Bush is unpopular among voters, he's still able to raise up to $500,000 per campaign stop. And he's doing just that in California for Republican incumbents, Representative Richard Pombo of Stockton and Representative John Doolittle of El Dorado. Both seats have likely Republican outcomes, but the races are getting closer. And Vice President Cheney is stumping for Texas candidates. One is the seat for former Congressman Tom DeLay. Despite the campaign season, the president's public comments turned to the scandal on Capitol Hill surrounding former Congressman Mark Foley. He defended top Republicans.
I know Denny Hastert, and he wants to ensure that these children up there at Capitol Hill are protected. I'm confident he will provide whatever leadership he can to law enforcement in this investigation.
Mark Foley resigned from his 16th Florida congressional district seat on Friday. His abrupt resignation has kept him out of the spotlight. Instead, the attention is turned to Republican leaders in the House of Representatives, who some suspect have covered up Foley's inappropriate activity. These allegations could have twice the negative effect in the upcoming elections. Republican leaders could be campaigning for colleagues. Instead, they're busy defending themselves. So they're losing time campaigning, but they're also losing support from their base. Richard Viguerie, author of Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Have Hijacked the Republican Cause, is also co-founder of the conservative movement 40 years ago. He says this is another episode that proves the entire Republican leadership must go.
We have a Republican leadership that has been primarily focused on holding on to power and protecting their members. And what they've been engaged in here is kind of circling the wagons and trying to protect their own members here. And it's very sad to see them lose their way like this.
The conservative newspaper in D.C., The Washington Times, called for the resignation of House Speaker Dennis Hastert. The paper writes in an editorial that Hastert was either negligent or deliberately looked the other way. Also engaged in damage control, House Majority Leader John Boehner responded with his own letter to the editor, in which he maintains Hastert's and his own innocence. Other conservatives did not go so far as to call for Hastert's resignation. In an internet statement, the Family Research Council focuses rather on Mark Foley, not the House leadership. They said it's not surprising that, quote, this is the end result of a society that rejects sexual restraints in the name of diversity. Paul Weyrich, a leading conservative activist, signed on to that statement. But he, too, is not happy with Republican leadership and what he calls a lack of conservative policies.
What they have done is all right. What they haven't done is what is troubling for most of us in the pro-life and pro-family community.
Conservative Richard Viguerie says this will take a toll in the November elections.
It's very, very disappointing to conservatives. 40 to 50% of the conservatives that I know at the grassroots level are either ambivalent or prefer a Democrat victory this fall. And I've never in 45 years of national politics seen conservatives this angry, this upset.
Democrats in recent weeks have used to their advantage several events. This Foley scandal, a release of an intelligence report that said the war in Iraq is making terrorism worse, and the release of a book by journalist Bob Woodward that shows infighting and cover-ups within the Bush administration over the war in Iraq. Sarah Steinberg, spokesperson at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, was reluctant to predict election outcomes, but she said the Foley scandal would be added to top issues for Democrats.
So you'll see campaigns talking about that and making that an issue. I think it's impossible not to talk about it as an issue.
Election watchdogs say it all comes down to what people feel on election day. Amy Cook is senior editor at the Cook Report.
What we have to figure out is, where is that spotlight going to be focusing as we get to the election? Is it going to be over on Iraq congressional dysfunction, or is it going to be over on territory that Republicans want it to be on?
Candidates have 5 more weeks from today to battle it out. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Craig Holman is the government ethics lobbyist for the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. KBU News spoke with him earlier today about the Mark Foley scandal.
Well, this is turning into a bigger deal than what it first sounded like. Literally, you know, we were hearing news break about this story Friday morning, and by Friday afternoon, Representative Mark Foley had resigned and left Washington, D.C. And it's like, I was thinking, okay, there must be some other emails that are, you know, very condemning of Mark Foley's activity, and that's why I left so quickly. But the story has continued to spiral beyond that. Now we find out that Representative Hastert had knowledge of these emails as long as a year ago, and along with Representative John Shimkus and others, other leaders of the Republican Party were well aware of this. They even conducted discussions and informal hearings about this type of activity and decided to sit on it. So this is something that the House Republican leadership was well aware of, and they covered it up for about a year. So it is spiraling. I mean, this just adds to all the Republican woes on Capitol Hill of all the different scandals, indictments, convictions, and resignations that we've seen happen. You know, 9 people so far have either been indicted, convicted, or resigned from Congress here in Capitol Hill just within this last year. And all of them Republicans at this point. Representative William Jefferson is a Democrat who's under investigation. But at this point, it's been mostly Republicans who have been caught in these scandals. And then when you add to it Representative Mark Foley acting in a very sleazy manner, I mean, it just drives the point home as to what's happened to this Republican Party on Capitol Hill. Well, in the very immediate short term, we're going to see Representative Hastert give up his leadership post. In the somewhat longer term, we're going to see Republicans suffer very serious defeats at the polls in November 2006. This, you know, could quite likely, most people expect the House already to go to the Democrats in 2006, and the Senate has always been up in the air. This could fuel the anti-Republican, anti-corruption fervor to a point where it could land the Democrats in control of the Senate as well. Once you have Democratic control in both the House and the Senate, it's going to be a major headache for the remainder of the Bush administration.
That was Craig Holman, public ethics lobbyist for Public Citizens.
Nurses permanently assigned to run hospital shifts should be considered supervisors and would thus be exempt from U.S. union protections. That's according to a federal panel which met today in a decision which could have major implications for the broader labor force. The National Labor Relations Board, in a 3-2 ruling, said people who work supervisor shifts only on a rotating basis may be exempt from supervisory status in some cases, but not others, depending on the frequency and consistency of the shifts. The decision was long awaited by both organized labor and business. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney immediately denounced the decision, saying the ruling invites employers, quote, to strip millions of workers of their right to have a union by reclassifying them as supervisors in name only, end quote. He sees the decision as an inroad helping companies to weaken union powers.
An Army soldier who fled to Canada rather than redeploy to Iraq surrendered today to military officials after asking for leniency. Specialist Daryl Anderson said he deserted the Army last year because he could no longer fight in what he believes is an illegal war. Anderson of Lexington, Virginia, returned to the United States from Canada on Saturday. He could face a charge of desertion. His lawyer, Jim Finnerty, he has said that he was told that the Army had decided not to court-martial his client and plans to release him with 3 to 5 days.
The Center for Constitutional Rights yesterday filed the first constitutional challenge to the Military Commissions Act, passed last week by Congress. Nan McCurdy has more from Washington, D.C.
The habeas corpus petition, filed on behalf of 25 detainees held at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, demands the U.S. government either charge the prisoners with the crime or release them. Some of the men have been held for years without ever receiving a hearing. The new bill, passed by Congress last week and signed by the President, denies prisoners the right to challenge their detention or treatment through traditional habeas corpus petitions. The bill also empowers the executive branch to indefinitely detain anyone it determines to have purposefully and materially supported anti-U.S. hostilities. Bill Goodman, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, calls the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus a shocking and sad moment in history. Activist group World Can't Wait is organizing emergency protests on Thursday in over 170 towns and cities to condemn the U.S. government's new guidelines for the treatment of detainees, which many say amounts to the official sanctioning of torture. For Free Speech Radio News from Washington, D.C., I'm Nan McCurdy.
The Miami Herald's publisher resigned today over revelations that his reporters were propagandists paid by the U.S. government. It was revealed 2 weeks ago that journalists with the Herald's Spanish-language sister paper, El Nuevo Herald, were paid to appear on U.S. government broadcasts aimed at destabilizing the Cuban government. Jesus Diaz Jr., the paper's publisher since July 2005, had dismissed two El Nuevo Herald reporters and a freelance contributor over the scandal. Diaz said the company would rehire the three he had dismissed for getting paid by Radio Marti and TV Marti. He said six others who took payments would not be disciplined. He also resigned his position as president of the Miami Herald Media Company. He said no one would be allowed in the future to accept money from the U.S. government-run broadcasters, and conflict of interest policies would be strengthened.
The U.S. Supreme Court this week started their new term by looking at two immigration cases. FSRN's Selena Mutsuda reports.
The court will be hearing the cases of Jose Antonio Lopez, a U.S. permanent resident and resident of South Dakota, as well as fellow Mexican national and Texas resident Raimundo Toledo Flores. Both were convicted with possession of a controlled substance, and the charges were considered felonies in their states. Lopez faces deportation, while Flores has already been deported. They argue that since their charges are misdemeanors under federal law, that immigration law should not adhere to the state classification of the conviction. Whatever decision that the court makes will affect thousands of immigrants facing automatic deportation, including long-term residents like Lindy Simon, who has been a green card holder for 32 years. After coming back from a trip to Trinidad, her native country, Simon received a letter ordering her to be deported for a drug offense that she committed 7 years ago. It was her first offense.
You know, everything is not black and white. You know, there is always room for error, and as humans, we do make mistakes.
Simon's mistake may cost her a home in the U.S. Since the age of 11, Simon has only known life in the New York City borough of Brooklyn.
My connection to Brooklyn is my life. My son, my grandmother, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins. I know nothing else.
But Simon's life in the U.S. was not taken into consideration when she received her deportation letter. The offense, marijuana possession, is a felony in the state of New York, but a misdemeanor under federal law. Because her charge is characterized as a drug trafficking aggravated felony, under 1996 amendments to the Immigration and Naturalization Law, Simon faces deportation automatically without a hearing. The government has argued before the Supreme Court that any drug crime that is a felony under federal or state law falls under the Immigration and Naturalization Act, but Bonita Jane, a staff attorney with the Immigration Defense Project of the New York State Defenders Association Immigrant Defense Project, says that the law is ambiguous and that immigration judges should follow the federal laws that clearly guide immigration proceedings. Jane was also at the Supreme Court hearing where Justice Ginsburg and Chief Justice John Roberts pointed out the inconsistencies in the way the government applies the immigration law.
Justice Roberts and Justice Ginsburg even pointed out the harsh effects of the government's position of treating a possession offense as a trafficking offense, as an aggravated felony. So we think, yes, the statute's complex, yes, the law is complex, but the complexity can and should be resolved against treating state possession offenses as drug trafficking aggravated felonies.
Selena Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
Stay tuned for Out Loud at 6 and Prison Pipeline at 6:30 following this newscast. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. Tomorrow, expect partly sunny skies in the afternoon after some morning fog with highs around 65. The Gorge may see a little rain. You are listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
And the current time is 5:36, and it's time for another Rootin' Tootin' Daily Commentary from our friend Jim Hightower.
When George W. talks publicly about his war in Iraq, he always points to his multinational partners, dubbing them the Coalition of the Willing, or COW. But who are these partners, and how willing are they, really? Actually, of 192 nations in the world, only 48 signed up for COW, including such mighty military machines as Estonia, Latvia, Micronesia, and the Solomon Islands. Of these 48 nations, only 39 sent any troops at all, with 39 sending less than 1,000 each, including many who sent only non-combat personnel. Of the 39 countries contributing troops, 17 have already withdrawn them, and another 7 are drawing down theirs this year. If these nations seem to have a very shaky commitment to Bush's COW, wait till you hear this. Bush has paid many of them to become our partners in war. It's received little publicity, but the Pentagon runs a special Coalition Solidarity Fund that slips payments to many COW members, essentially buying their involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. In 2005, for example, we taxpayers paid to airlift 2,400 Polish troops to Iraq. Then we built their camps for them and provided equipment. On top of this, we simply gave $57 million to Poland from that Solidarity Fund. Meanwhile, Poland is planning to withdraw all of its troops from Iraq next year. The coalition was constructed by the Bushites at the start of their war to try giving it an image of international legitimacy. But, as international security expert Patricia Weitzman writes, few people worldwide believe that the U.S. pays attention to the interests of others when making policy decisions. Their perception of America as unilateralist is pervasive. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bush's COW is a papier-mâché fraud constructed with our money. Just another of his endless war of lies.
This Jim Hightower Common Sense Commentary is brought to you by the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation. To learn more, visit www.joinmpp.org or call toll-free 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Returning to the states which dashed his presidential hopes in 2004, Democrat U.S. Senator John Kerry rallied with college students today for next month's elections, urging them to, quote, take back Ohio, take back our country, unquote. Kerry, who conceded the 2004 election after he lost Ohio's 20 electoral votes, defended the Democrats against accusations by Republicans that it has no ideas. He cited plans by Democrats for health care, education, jobs, and trade, and global warming. Ohio Democrats hope to gain this fall from a state scandal which has unfolded under Republican leadership and which has hurt Governor Bob Taft and others. Republicans control statewide offices, the House and Senate, and the Ohio Supreme Court.
At a pivotal time in the abortion debate, Ms. Magazine is releasing its fall issue next week with a cover story entitled We Had Abortions, accompanied by the names of thousands of women nationwide who signed a petition making that declaration. The publication coincides with what the abortion rights movement considers a watershed moment for its cause. Abortion access in many states is being curtailed. South Dakotans vote November 7th on a measure which would ban virtually all abortions in their state, even in cases of rape and incest. Activists are uncertain about the stance of the U.S. Supreme Court. Tuesday, the Ms. Executive Editor Catherine Spiller said more than 5,000 women have signed the petition so far. The magazine itself had room to publish only 1,016 names, but all of them will be available online. Ms. says it will send the petition to Congress, the White House, and state legislations.
A federal judge is telling tobacco companies to keep their light and low-tar cigarettes off the market for now. Judge Gladys Kessler ruled in August that cigarette makers misled the public about how smoking lights could still be hazardous to their health. And she concluded that they broke racketeering laws with their marketing tactics. The companies asked Kessler to hold off on enforcing an order for them to stop selling light cigarettes until an appeal is complete. Something that could take years. The company says they'll lose business, but Kessler says the appropriate remedy for past lawbreaking may well be the price defendants have to pay. Still, they ask an appeals court to put the ruling on hold.
The British newspaper The Guardian has published the details of secret talks between the U.S. and Britain, wherein the U.S. offered to send back most of the 9 British residents detained at Guantanamo Bay. But Britain, it seems, is refusing their return. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Many of the men concerned have lived in Britain for up to 20 years. They have children and other family members who are British citizens. Because they never formalised their British passports, they fell through the gaps during negotiations for the return of British citizens from Guantanamo Bay. The British government has always denied legal or moral responsibility for the return of these men. The men's lawyers say they continue to suffer ill treatment in Guantanamo Bay, with 4 being subjected to the extremes of freezing cold and then high heat. The unwillingness of the British government to accept them back into Britain may be because they know they'll encounter problems in trying to deport them. They're already being blocked by the courts from deporting other men whom they refer to as terrorist suspects, who they say are a threat to security. Like all the Guantanamo Bay detainees, none has been found guilty of any crime by the courts. Some have even been tried and acquitted of all charges. The government is seeking diplomatic assurances from countries like Algeria that they'll not torture or execute deportees in an attempt to find a way round Britain's obligations under international law. The US doesn't want these British residents either because they also will have legal problems in returning them to possible persecution in their countries of origin. Foreign Office officials have denied that any talks are taking place. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
American attorneys for 25 men being held in Afghanistan yesterday filed papers to demand that the men be either released or charged and allowed to meet with their attorneys. Such a filing, known as a habeas corpus petition, is prohibited under legislation approved by Congress last week. The bill says the military could detain enemy combatants indefinitely, and if officials choose to bring charges, the cases would be heard before a military commission, not a civilian judge. Bush has not signed the bill, but expects to soon. Supporters say it's a necessary tool in the war on terrorism. Monday's filing initiates what is likely to be a drawn-out legal fight similar to the one over detainees at a military prison in Guantanamo Bay. Detainees there have dozens of petitions pending.
The Pentagon announced today that 4 U.S. soldiers were killed Monday evening while they were patrolling a neighborhood in northern Baghdad. The killings come after the deaths of 5 Marines in the Anbar province over the weekend. More than 2,700 U.S. troops have died since George Bush invaded Iraq in 2003. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died during the same time, among them at least 161 professors. Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib filed this report on Iraq's brain drain.
Students at Iraq's universities were to start the new school year this week. No small task given the daily barrage of violence that surrounds them. Basil al-Khatib, spokesman for the country's Ministry of Higher Education, says the government is doing what it can to make schools safe for students and faculty members.
Our ministry is the Ministry of Education. We don't have a military, and we can't make one of our own. And we can't make a militia. Our job is education. All that we have are some campus guards. Until now, we have been successful. We have kept the campus safe, but outside the campus, we can do nothing. Outside the campus, the students and the teachers can be killed while they are on their way home or even in their houses, and we cannot do anything about that.
According to the ministry, at least 180 professors have been killed since February, when a mosque bombing in Samarra sent sectarian violence skyrocketing around the country. Basim al-Abdali is a professor of sociology at Baghdad University.
And there is even more on the ground. We can't really deny that. But in most of the cases, teachers have been killed outside the university. Sometimes they get killed while they are shopping, and sometimes even randomly. And sometimes in the violence that's in the streets at all times.
It's difficult to tell who's killing Iraq's academics. Nabil Al-Takriti, an assistant professor of history at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia, says Iraqi academics are being killed in a different way than their countrymen.
They're very professional assassinations. Professional meaning that they're only going after the person that they want to get. So they're not so much dying in car bombs or sectarian killings where a checkpoint is set up and everybody's being killed that goes through that checkpoint that's of the wrong sectarian identity. They're not being killed in those random senses. Instead, there's assassins that go up to them at a place of work or sometimes in transit or sometimes their house and kill them and only them.
The killing of so many professors has compelled many of those still alive to flee the country. The Ministry of Higher Education estimates at least 3,250 have fled since February. Again, Basim al-Abdali, professor of sociology at Baghdad University.
The biggest problem is to avoid the brain drain, and the only way to fight that is to make a safe environment where the professors can stay. So we suggested that we should have the professors living on campus, or at least within one block of the campus. And that way, we can avoid putting the professors in direct contact with the streets until the situation gets calmer than it is now.
Students, too, need solutions to stay safe. Professor Basim al-Abdali says Iraq's universities are now allowing students to transfer colleges on the basis of their ethnic group, so they can attend university in neighborhoods whose residents have the same ethnic background as they do.
We have a strategy for students. The students that have been accepted in other universities where there is sectarian violence, where the local population is from a different group than their own, we will transfer them to a university which is safer than their own. Even the University of Baghdad, which is the most prestigious university in the country. They'll be in the exchange program, so they won't be registered as students at that university. They'll just study there.
It's difficult to tell who's behind all of this violence. Analysts alternately blame militia organizations, Ba'athists, anti-Ba'athists, the Iranian Secret Service, the Israeli Mossad, and the U.S. military. Nabil al-Takriti of the University of Mary Washington says Americans should push their government for an investigation.
I think there should be investigations into why there are assassinations of academics, because not a single one of these cases has been solved. And is there a plot somewhere, and it may not even be the U.S. government, but is anyone involved in a plot to target them as a group? And if so, why? And if so, can there any justice be done? Because this kind of dirty war is contributing to the breakdown of Iraqi society, which is in turn contributing to the disaster that is Iraq, which is not just a disaster for Iraqis, but is ultimately a disaster for Americans as well.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
Aid agencies say around 400,000 people are still without permanent shelter following last year's earthquake in northern Pakistan. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies have called for more funding. More than 80,000 people were killed and another 3.5 million left homeless by the earthquake, which devastated parts of Pakistan-administered Kashmir and the northern West Frontier province last October.
After natural disasters hit some of the world's poorest countries, they often turn to the United States for aid. In exchange for the needed help, stricken countries such as Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, and Indonesia are obliged to liberalize their markets and deregulate essential services like water and electricity. Some critics see the exchange as the latest form of colonialism. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
Walton Bellow is the executive director of the NGO Focus on the Global South and also professor of sociology at the University of the Philippines. Bellow says that disasters are seen as opportunities by certain global players.
What we see now is that in addition to relief and reconstruction, you do have an institutional complex that has strategic objectives and at the same time involves the private sector to a degree that it becomes a business, so to speak. And then you have non-governmental organizations also involved that have a certain bias toward certain parts of the population rather than others. And then you have the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, oftentimes, that skew reconstruction in a certain way, which is to deregulate economies and to push economies to more kind of market solutions or market institutions. So I call this the relief and reconstruction complex. This is no longer the old-fashioned kind of relief for disasters that was directed at everybody who was suffering. This is, at this point, highly politicized towards the objectives of the United States and of, you know, Western countries.
Bellow, Klein, and others say imposing democracy and a market economy on a country via relief and reconstruction efforts is another form of Western colonialism. However, Andrea Binder from the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin says that some countries may be in such a bad way that restructuring the economy and political system is necessary in order to rebuild the nation.
I just don't see like any evil in general in trying to bring like market economy and democracy to the people. The question is how you're doing it. And there I have a lot to criticize about American, you know, way of doing it, but it's the same if the American government is doing it, or maybe the European government is not better at all, or like American or European NGOs. It's just they do not care enough about local people, and they all think they have the concept to do it.
The distribution of aid money to NGOs, as opposed to afflicted governments, presents another set of problems. Peter Wahl from the Berlin-based NGO World Ecology, Economy and Development, or WEED, says that there needs to be a discussion within the NGO community about NGO codes of conduct. But it's also the opportunism of business in regions like Afghanistan and Iraq that needs to be addressed.
I think there is a good chance after the Iraq war and the disaster that happened there, where you can see in a paradigmatic way how this functions with Halliburton, with Bechtel, with the whole oil extracting industries and reconstruction and construction industry that are making huge profits. So we should use this experience to confront this trend.
Far from Weed believes that we need to rethink the concept of the relief and reconstruction industry. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
Tension remains high in Oaxaca City as military flights continue, creating a general anxiety among residents over a possible massive crackdown against a popular movement demanding the resignation of the state's governor. Mexico's attorney general said he's looking into a case of small explosions that shattered windows and glass doors at three different banks in Oaxaca City yesterday. A previously unknown guerrilla group claimed responsibility for the blast, although many suspects the attacks were staged to create a pretext for intervention by federal forces.
Levy Mwanawasa has claimed victory in Zambia's presidential elections. Mwanawasa won a second term in office with 43% of the vote, while his main challenger, Michael Sata, received 29%. Sata has claimed massive fraud, and his supporters have staged 2 days of violent protests. The Electoral Commission is investigating the complaints.
Militants in the Niger Delta region have killed 5 soldiers during an attack on a boat convoy carrying supplies for the multinational oil company Shell Petroleum. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
10 soldiers and at least 16 oil contractors are missing after yesterday's attack on a supply boat convoy. Some of the oil workers employed by the Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell Petroleum are believed to have been kidnapped. A militant group, the Niger Delta People's Volunteer Force, has claimed responsibility for the attack. The group threatened more attacks unless a separatist leader, Mujahid Asare Dokubo, is released. Dokubo is in the forefront of the struggle waged by communities in the Niger Delta against Western oil companies in the area. The communities want a share of oil revenue. Militants have in recent months been taking foreign oil workers hostage. Just last month, oil workers went on strike to protest the growing insecurity in the Niger Delta. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The human rights group Global Witnesses is urging Liberian government to renegotiate a multi-million dollar mining deal. The group says the current contract with Mittal Steel gives too much power to the world's largest steel company and too few returns to the impoverished country. The agreement was struck by the former interim government. Current President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has said that she will review all contracts negotiated by the former government.
Thailand's ousted Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra has resigned as leader of the party that he created. A party spokesman said Thaksin was leaving the Thai Rak Thai party because of, quote, changing circumstances. Thaksin was ousted in a military coup 2 weeks ago and is currently living in London. Scores of ministers have resigned from Thai Rak Thai since the coup.
Well, that's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock-Revis. Our wire editors are Lisa Loving and Helen Honey. Tonight's audio editor is Elisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Mike Monkbold, Lisa Loving, Stephanie Potter, and Amy Merwin. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And stick with us at 7:30 for Barbara Bernstein hosting Locus Focus Talk Radio. Her guest is going to be media critic Jeff Cohen of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. His newest book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. At 9 on The Bike Show, Eileen Crotty and Tim Calvert will discuss great bike rides all around Portland, including the Springwater Corridor. And at 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller welcomes eminent historian Howard Zinn to talk about his latest book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. At 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And at noon on Alternative Radio, activist author Jonathan Kozel speaks on Education, the Shame of the Nation. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our broadcast by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you consider becoming a member.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Thank you for tuning in. Tonight, the Out Loud Collective is taking a well-deserved break, painting their toenails red, eating chocolate bonbons, and just putting their feet up. So we feature This Way Out. And I have to tell you, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. Also, Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net. Also, This Way Out is sponsored by, in other words, Women's Books and Resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingsworth at Williams. In other words, is your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003 or inotherwords.org. Stay tuned for This Way Out. It's 6:01 and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
I'd say I realized that I was a lesbian when I was about 15. It was real hard for me then because I didn't know anyone else that was a lesbian besides myself.
It's not being gay that's disadvantageous. It's the society that persecutes gay people that makes it difficult to be gay.
Better blatant than latent.
Let's flaunt it, let's flaunt it, let's celebrate our love. I want to proliferate our love.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. South Africa's would-be president stumbles homophobically. New Zealand Presbyterians keep to the straight and narrow. And get ready to talk about it on National Coming Out Day. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 30th, 2006. South Africa's former Deputy President Jacob Zuma, who could be the nation's next president, provoked outrage this week by calling homosexuality un-African and criticizing the pending legal recognition of same-gender unions. The country's constitution is the world's first to specifically ban discrimination based on sexual orientation, and its highest court last year ordered Parliament to enact laws to establish marriage equality for same-gender couples by December 1st. It ruled that South Africa's Marriage Act will automatically include same-gender couples if Parliament fails to act by that deadline. Zuma was quoted by the Sowetan newspaper as saying, "Same-sex marriage is a disgrace to the nation and to God," at a gathering in his native KwaZulu-Natal. Meanwhile, thousands of people, led by the African Christian Democratic Party, marched in several South African cities in mid-September to protest the government's plan to pass a civil unions bill that would give same-gender couples the same rights as married people, though it's unclear if such separate but equal legislation will satisfy the High Court. South African President Thabo Mbeki had fired Zuma for having a generally corrupt relationship with a former aide, but he remains popular and continues to lead the African National Congress, or ANC. The ANC party leader is virtually assured the country's presidency, and because a court threw out the corruption charges against him last week, Zuma appears to be a strong candidate to succeed Mbeki when he steps down in 2009. It would seem Jacob Zuma still has a lot to learn about leadership. The Joint Working Group, representing South Africa's biggest queer advocacy organizations, said in a statement, "A true leader leads with intellect and wisdom, not popularity or favor. How can a narrow-minded person like this be expected to lead our nation?" Zuma quickly issued an apology, saying that he did not intend to have my statements interpreted as a condemnation of gays and lesbians, and that he respected the sterling contribution of many gay and lesbian compatriots in the struggle that brought about our freedom.
In a significant victory for U.S. marriage equality advocates, a Superior Court judge ruled this week that a lesbian couple from Rhode Island can legally marry in Massachusetts under the Supreme Judicial Court's 2003 ruling that legalized gay and lesbian weddings in that state. Wendy Becker and Mary Norton of Providence, Rhode Island, challenged a 1913 Massachusetts law that forbids out-of-state residents from marrying there if the marriage would not be legally recognized in their home state. The couple argued that it didn't apply to them because Rhode Island doesn't specifically ban same-gender marriage. In his 9-page ruling, Judge Thomas Connolly agreed, writing that no evidence was introduced before this court of a constitutional amendment, statute, or controlling appellate decision from Rhode Island that explicitly deems void or otherwise expressly forbids same-sex marriage. 8 couples from 6 nearby states originally challenged the law. In March, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court upheld it, but said the laws on legal same-gender unions were unclear in New York and Rhode Island, and reserved judgment on that part of the case. In July, New York's highest court ruled that its state law limits marriage to one man and one woman. Same-gender couples from Rhode Island, at least for now, are the only ones from out of state who can marry in Massachusetts. State Attorney General Thomas Riley, who had defended the 1913 law in court, said officials in Rhode Island could challenge Connolly's decision, but that his office would not appeal. Becker and Norton, a couple for 19 years and the parents of 2 children, said in a statement that, "After a very long engagement, we are thrilled to be able to marry and provide our family with the legal protection and social recognition we deserve. Our desire to marry has always been with our children in mind. We want them to feel their family is as worthy as any other."
The Georgia Court of Appeals this week returned to lesbian mother Victoria Moses primary custody of her 12-year-old daughter, ruling that having a live-in same-gender partner had no adverse effect on the child. Custody had been awarded by a trial court judge to the girl's father, Kelvin King, citing Moses' living arrangements as being outside the presence of marriage, even though gay and lesbian couples can't legally marry in the state. In reversing the lower court, Georgia Court of Appeals Judge Ann Elizabeth Barnes wrote that the evidence suggests that the child was doing well in school, loved the mother's partner, and was happy and well-balanced. Jack Centerfit, senior staff attorney in Lambda Legal's Atlanta office, represented Moses. He praised the court's ruling, saying, "This is really great news for our client and gay and lesbian parents in Georgia. It means custody arrangements can't be challenged just because a parent is gay or lesbian."
A gay male couple in Spain's Air Force was married in a mid-September ceremony in the city of Seville. Privates Alberto Linero Marquena and Alberto Sanchez Fernandez tied the knot at City Hall in uniform before friends and family. Mayor Alfredo Sanchez Montserin officiated, saying, "This is not just your wedding. You symbolize millions of people who are not here and suffer from homophobia." Spain is one of 5 countries where same-gender couples have access to traditional marriage.
In other news, the General Assembly of New Zealand's Presbyterian Church voted this week to reaffirm its ban on gays and lesbians from holding leadership roles within the church. In revisiting a 2004 vote, the church's top legislative body, by a 65% margin, approved a statement that the church may not accept for training, license, ordain, or induct anyone involved in a sexual relationship outside of faithful marriage between a man and a woman. The rule doesn't apply to any church member ordained as a minister prior to 2004 and can't be used to remove anyone from such a position. According to 2006 national census figures, 11% of New Zealand's approximately 4 million people identify as Presbyterian, making the church the third largest in the country. Openly lesbian minister Margaret Maiman warned that the ban may be broken by more progressive parishes who will flout the law and choose leaders for their commitment to the gospel rather than for their sexual orientation.
And a United Nations-sponsored workshop in Kariba this week was expected to lay the groundwork for the creation of a human rights commission in Zimbabwe. But gay and lesbian concerns won't be part of that process. GALS, the Gay and Lesbian Association of Zimbabwe, was banned from participating in the workshop by the government of vociferously homophobic President Robert Mugabe, who's described lesbians and gays as worse than dogs and pigs, and threatened pro-queer clergy with prison sentences. GALS spokesperson Fambe Ngerande complained that we must be allowed to enjoy freedom of association as any other individuals do, and called the exclusion of GALS an abrogation of our rights.
Meanwhile, the Filipino gay organization Ang Ladlad has registered a candidate in Manila who'll run for Congress in 2007. Chairperson Danton Ramoto told local media that the group wants to reclaim the rights we have lost from centuries of homophobia and discrimination. Ang Ladlad means coming out. The Manila Bulletin said it comes from the word Magladlad, which means to unfurl the cape that used to cover one's body as a shield.
And finally, former New Jersey Governor James McGreevy's The Confession has jumped onto the bestseller list. It comes on the heels of his whirlwind promotional appearances on U.S. TV talk shows this week. The book chronicles McGreevy's coming out as a gay American while resigning from office amidst contentious he said accounts of the then governor's relationship with a male staff member. The Confession has been met with both praise and ridicule. Gay journalist Andy Hum wrote that McGreevy wasted his life living a lie. Now he wants us to waste our time reading more of them. Meanwhile, openly lesbian and gay candidates have enjoyed notable victories in U.S. state elections so far this year, including historic wins in such formerly unlikely places as Alabama, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. But a conservative six-term Republican U.S. congressman from Florida, who's long been rumored to be a closeted gay man, has abruptly resigned from office. There are certain things we shouldn't discuss in public, 52-year-old and unmarried Mark Foley once told a press conference when asked about his sexual orientation. Some people may think that's old-fashioned, but I firmly believe it's a good rule to live by. Not so good were the lascivious emails and instant messages reported this week as having been sent by Foley to some teenage male pages. Pages are usually high school students who attend classes under congressional supervision and work as messengers for the lawmakers. In an instant message exchange with one of those young male pages, Foley wrote, "Do I make you horny?" and asked the 16-year-old for a photo and to strip down and get naked. Copies of even more salacious emails and instant messages surfaced in the short time between the initial reports and the congressman's resignation. "I am deeply sorry and I apologize for letting down my family and the people of Florida I have had the privilege to represent," Foley said in a statement issued by his office with no other words of explanation. His departure has sent Republicans scrambling for a replacement candidate 6 weeks before midterm elections, in which Foley was expected to easily win another term. Sparked by the poor public approval ratings of President George W. Bush, Democrats are making a strong bid across the country to gain control of Congress. And while there's no connection between sexual predators and sexual orientation, in fact, numerous studies show that such perpetrators are overwhelmingly heterosexual men, it's perhaps sadly ironic that Foley was chairperson of the Congressional Missing and Exploited Children's Caucus.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 30th, 2006, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
You'll soon find out what everyone will be talking about on October 11th. But first, we kick off LGBT History Month with an enlightening new series.
Harvey Milk, Gay Hero, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute.
Harvey Milk was born in New York in 1930. After college graduation and a short stint in the Navy, he moved to San Francisco and opened his own camera shop. As an outspoken advocate for his community, he longed for deeper involvement through political office. In 1977, he was elected to San Francisco's City Council, making him one of the first openly gay politicians in the country. As a gay man working for many progressive causes, he knew he could be a target. In 1978, he was assassinated by former City Councilman Dan White. But by then, his place in history had been cemented. Harvey had consistently stressed the importance of defeating homophobia by coming out. He said, quote, "Every gay person must come out. Once they realize we are indeed their children, and we are indeed everywhere, every myth, every lie, every innuendo will be destroyed once and for all." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRAR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Just one tiny note of correction. Both Harvey Milk and his assassin, Dan White, served on the City and County of San Francisco Board of Supervisors.
It's all right. You may all come out.
The 18th annual National Coming Out Day is celebrated across the U.S. on October 11th. Sponsored by the Human Rights Campaign and endorsed by virtually every queer advocacy group, events on that day encourage gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people to talk about it with family, friends, and co-workers, a personal approach proven to be the most effective educational tool there is. This Way Out observes National Coming Out Day with what we hope is a sparkling collage of music, humor, and some words of wisdom.
My sweet cherry, how long will you run? No hiding place over there, over there. Nobody knows you, and even though you say they do, you can't tell them who you really are.
I'd say I realized that I was a lesbian when I was about 15. It was real hard for me then because I didn't know anyone else that was a lesbian besides myself.
I believe that life was exactly the way the minister said it was in the pulpit. And when I had gay feelings, I used to just cry on my knees and pray to God that I wouldn't be gay.
I was about 2 months from my 26th birthday. I had been told by other people that I was a latent homosexual, but I didn't feel that it was true.
But if everybody said,
but if everybody said,
but if everybody said,
don't act like that,
don't show us that,
don't smile like that,
don't run like that,
don't throw like that,
don't dress like that, don't walk like that,
don't talk like that,
don't laugh like that,
don't be like that, don't be like that, don't be like that, don't be like that.
How come I'm still like that?
Excuse me. Can I ask you a personal question?
Excuse me, but could I ask you a personal question?
Are you gay or what?
It just makes me a little uncomfortable.
I really don't want to hear it.
I'd really rather not talk about it right now.
Hey, what you do is your own business.
Just don't talk about
it. Just don't talk about
it. Just don't talk about it.
For God's sakes, don't talk about it.
Just don't talk about it.
This is your captain speaking. We've reached our cruising altitude, so sit back and relax for the rest of the flight. We expect a smooth ride, and by the way, I'm gay.
Maybe talking about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender equality over a loudspeaker isn't the best approach. But what about talking to the passenger next to you? Wherever you are, talk about it. Every word is a step, and the Human Rights Campaign can help. Visit hrc.org.
Everybody is frightened about making the disclosure to somebody who's important to them in their life, whether it's a parent or whether it's an employer, for instance.
Dr. Don Clark, author of Loving Someone Gay and Living Gay.
try to sort out what are the worst things that could really happen, because sometimes the fantasies are so catastrophic that they're way out of line with reality.
My mother or my father will have a cardiac arrest and die right in front of me.
Yeah, traditionally, father has a cardiac arrest, mother jumps out of the window, and the boss fires you. I mean, everybody knows that's going to happen. So try to figure out from what you know about mother, father, or the employer what their reactions are likely to be. What's the worst thing that can happen to you?
What about the factor of being totally comfortable with yourself as a gay person before you make the disclosure to those people close to you? Isn't that important?
That's very important, yes. If you're making an announcement to somebody who cares about you, you're making a disclosure of your gay identity, and you're talking about it as if having just discovered that you've got cancer, please don't expect a straight person to celebrate with you if they care about you at all. You've got to come to terms with it yourself in a way that's not just accepting this malaise that you have, but you have to first get to the point where you appreciate what a really good thing that is in your life, what the advantages of it are, the possible richness that that can bring to you. Once you have that firmly in your heart, soul, and mind, then is the time to announce it to other people who care about you. Secondly, figure out whether this is a person that you really do need to tell. I mean, there's no more burden on us than there is on a heterosexual person. You don't have to tell everybody in the world that you're gay. It's not a matter of concern for some people. A friend of mine said he was so weary of making the disclosure that he thought he'd just put an ad in the newspaper and leave town for a month. Let everybody know. But try to sort out whether it's costing you some kind of emotional energy to not tell that person. If it's something on your mind a lot, you're thinking about it a lot, it's causing you to lose sleep, you don't need that kind of loss of energy, so it's probably better to confront the issue with that person. They'll ask all the usual naive questions. Did you go to a doctor and try to get it fixed? Why do you have to be that way? What do you want to have so much grief in your life for? Why don't you try to get over it, etc.? And there are answers to all those questions, a lot of it having to do with that's who I am. You know, if I were left-handed, would you want to send me to a doctor to make me right-handed? Which we did once upon a time.
Yeah.
It's not being gay that's disadvantageous. It's the society that persecutes gay people that makes it difficult to be gay.
Finally, I resolved it within myself, and then it made it much easier for my family and friends to accept me after I had accepted myself.
Woman, although I play one on TV. But acting belongs in television or in the movies, not in real life. I decided to come out as a lesbian. And this year on National Coming Out Day, you come out. Stop acting. Make the step that's right for you.
We were out in the country, spreading our wings wild and free, learning about life from the
Doug Stevens.
And we're the Out Band.
The official gay and lesbian ambassadors of country music.
And you're listening to
This Way Out, the international
lesbian
and gay magazine.
Hello, my friends. I'm Mother Nature. Isn't it a lovely day today? I'd just like to take a moment to talk to all of my gay children out there. You straights, be patient for a moment. This is only for my lovely gay children to hear. Now listen. Do you hear my sweet birds singing? Isn't it beautiful? Now sometimes my birds sing because they're hungry, sometimes because they're scared. But it's a scientific fact that most often they sing simply because they're happy. Now, isn't that nice? And so it is with my lovely human beings. Sometimes you have sex to make babies, sometimes to make friends, but most often simply because it makes you happy. And I want to tell all my lovely lesbians and gay men out there that you're not only Mother Nature's children, but among my favorites, because you know how to make yourselves happy. That's all Mother wanted to say. Have a nice day now, and buckle your galoshes.
Wait a minute. Just wait a minute. I'd like to say one last thing. Hold on just a second. This is Lula talking. In case any of you folks out there thought this little show here was in bad taste. Well, let me just remind you what my hairdresser, Grover, used to say. He used to say, better blatant than latent.
Let's flaunt it, let's flaunt it, let's celebrate our love. I want to proliferate our love.
I'm an avowed homosexual and you're a practicing one. Long as we're gonna go to hell, we might as well have some fun. We'll stir up some trouble just by holding hands. Stop traffic, start rumors relating man to man.
Let's flaunt it, let's flaunt it, let's celebrate our love. I want to proliferate our love.
I'm a self-confessed lesbian and you're an admitted one. Long as we're gonna burn in hell, we might as well have some fun. We'll upset the neighbors, especially the men, 'cause woman to woman is threatening to them.
Sodomy!
Sodomy!
Fellatio!
Fellatio!
Cunnilingus! Let's let it show!
Degenerate and you're an irreverent one. Long as we're on the road to hell, we might as well have some fun. And just like the army, we'll increase our troops. Get tips on recruitment from fundamentalist groups.
Let's flaunt it, let's flaunt it, let's celebrate our love. I want to proliferate our love. I want to proliferate our love. Proliferate our love. Proliferate our love.
For the straight folks who don't mind gays but wish they weren't so blatant.
Lesbian feminist poet and activist Pat Parker.
You know, some people got a lot of nerve. Sometimes I don't believe the things I see and hear. Have you met the woman who's shocked by two women kissing and in the same breath tells you that she's pregnant? But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or this straight couple sits next to you in a movie and you can't hear the dialogue because of the sound effects. But gays shouldn't be blatant. And the woman in your office spends your whole lunch hour talking about her new bikini drawers and how much her husband likes them. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or the hip chick in your class rattling a mile a minute while you're trying to get stoned in a john about the camping trip she took with her musician boyfriend. But gays shouldn't be blatant. You go in a public bathroom, and all over the walls, there's John loves Mary, Janice digs Richard, Pepe loves Dolores, etc. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or you go to an amusement park, and there's a tunnel of love, and pictures of straights painted on the front, and grinning couples coming in and out. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Fact is, blatant heterosexuals are all over the place. Supermarkets, movies, at work, in church, in books, on television, every day and night, every place, even in gay bars. And they want gay men and women to go hide in the closets. So to you straight folks, I say, sure, I'll go, if you go too. But I'm polite, so after you. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, John Beaupre, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Dustin Richardson contributed program material. You heard performances by Philip Coquette, Michael Katz, David Gaines, Prince Panisi, Dusty Street, and Lily Tomlin in our National Coming Out Day special feature with music by Mary Watkins, Styx, and Romanofsky and Phillips. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special CD thank you gifts. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WXOJ Northampton, Massachusetts, to ECR Eden, New South Wales, KMUE and KMUD, Eureka and Garberville, California, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Come out for equality and stay tuned.
For another edition of Prison Pipeline on KBOO. I'm your host, Reggae Bob. One of the fastest half hours on radio, that is for sure. Sitting in solo this week, Sister Ruth is, I think she's out and about. She's going to be traveling and visiting some other cities, and she's going to be checking in with us on her things and what she's doing. Okay, tonight in this Big Bad Fast Half Hour, we're going to have our Mumia Abu-Jamal segment. And this week he's speaking about the 40th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. Yes, indeed, the 40th anniversary. Also, this week, we're going to talk a little bit about some prisoner letters that I've received over the past couple of months. Let the people know that I have not forgot about them. And some of them have some wishes that they would like to have fulfilled easily, folks, easily. Maybe you can help. Also got a report on the Skywalker, Daryl Skywalker case down in Eugene. Excuse me. Yeah, his case is in Eugene. He's in Ontario. The march was in Salem on Saturday. It's Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Reggae Bob. Yes, indeed. First, want to give a shout out to Uhuru Sasa. I understand the chapter's opened up back again, and they're going to have a big meeting on the 10th, October the 10th. So, hope y'all have a good meeting down there, and it mentioned something about guests. We haven't received any information about guests down there or us coming down or invites, but I know myself and Shahid and others, spirits will be down there with y'all. Have a good meeting, and hopefully get a good strong chapter going again. Yeah, and I, for one thing, I want to apologize a little bit. On my other show, I mentioned that it was going to be the last good time show last month. I've done the last good time show. I'm still going to be here, but I was changing the name of the show. But the name change didn't get done in the KBOO guide, so we got one more month of good times. Thursday, 7 to 9. All right. And we're going to start off with some letters here. This is dated earlier this year. Have Brother R.B., last name Brown. I hope that's okay, R.B. And he heard he was newly incarcerated at down at OSP. And he had heard about KBOO radio station, not just Prison Pipeline, but the station as a whole. Mentioned that he had been doing some pirate internet radio. Excuse me. He had owned and operated an internet radio station and also did some pirate station with that. And we know how some people do that, have their own radio station. That's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. Legal or not, I can't remember exactly how it all goes. But since then, he's been incarcerated. And he's making good use of his time there. Wants to get his own radio station going. That's a lot of hard work, RB. Let me tell you, I don't know if he can do a whole radio station by yourself. But KBOO always got room for you. We got some love for you here. So when you get out in 2008, come check out KBOO. And it says here that you're helping to clerk and tutor for the recently restarted education program. I sure hope that's going good and strong down there. And hey, this gentleman, he's in Salem. He's got nobody to write to him, he says. He has nobody to help him or to write him. So if you want to write him, give me a shout out. Give me an email at reggaebob@comcast.net. Reggaebob, like it sounds, @comcast.net. And we'll hook you up with this brother's ID and mail information. And you could write him and keep in touch with him if you like. Radioactive. Also, another brother down there, SB. SB, we got you here too. And another member of Uhuru Sasa speaking about the chapter starting back up and looking at their movie library that they got there. Not a good movie library at all. And he's been this SB has been appointed the new movie coordinator. And he wants to get the word out that Uhuru Sasa at OSP needs movies to be donated. And they have to be a new release. Got to be brand new in the box, movie or DVD. It could be educational, it could be about African culture, or even an old classic. And but they can't violate the rules of the DOC. And these are movies that with rape or anything with prison escape. And of course, we understand that. But hey, if you want to do that, also email me on that one, and we'll try to get down there and get you guys some new movies to check with and uplift you down there. If not, at the very latest, Christmas. Or, as we say, Kwanzaa, baby. Coming up in just a little while. Okay, that's it for the letter portion this week. Well, I'll let you guys know we're not forgetting about you. No, big up to you all. MJ, thanks for the letters, MJ. I'm not leaving. Okay. And we have our Mumia Abu-Jamal moment coming right up right now on Prison Pipeline, KBOO style. Talked about the 40th anniversary of the Black Panther Party.
40 years after, on the move, all power to the people. Brothers, sisters, comrades, all who struggled to bring our people freedom, I greet you. What can we say on the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party? Do we share the joy of our common struggles? Do we share our sorrow at the fall of the party? Do we search the political horizon for those who yet struggle for a new day for our people? Do we reminisce on the good old days past when the revolution seemed in our hands? The simple answer, of course, is yes. Among us all, surely, are some who join at least some of these observations. Many of us are justly proud of our service in the movement, and many of us, even though the party has been defunct for decades, remain active in social movements, working in our communities, trying to make life better in the face of the long white war against black freedom and liberation. Yet, I know, if we're honest, that many of you felt the tremendous void when Hurricane Katrina ravaged our people and the political elites added grievous insult to injury by attacking poor blacks for not drowning quietly. I felt longing for the party, for a political entity strong enough, committed enough to defend our people in times of need. I longed for a party that could organize that vast and deep black angst and rage, not for an election, not for a politician, but for independent action in our own interests. That said, it was refreshing to see Malik Rahim, a former party member, take the lead in speaking out on behalf of the people of New Orleans, organizing support and, yes, survival programs, remember that, for those most in need. His training was not in vain. 40 years ago, social conditions gave rise to the party. Today, we face equally grim, if not worse, social conditions. To read the 10-point program today is almost like reading the morning paper. For unemployment, police terror, injustices in the courts, a damnable educational system, these things still plague our people's lives. Yet a program without a party is like a screw without a screwdriver. It can't work. I'm here to report to you the independent initiation of the New African Black Panther Party, which, unlike similar such formations, has young members who truly study the lives and writings of Dr. Huey P. Newton, Eldridge Cleaver, George Jackson, and other OPs, you know, original Panthers, who made contributions to our people's struggle. They call their ideology Pantherism. I think the OPs will be proud. In other words, the struggle continues. Huey, for all of his problems, was a man of immense brilliance who foretold the fall of the Soviet Union and the expansion of imperialism. It's refreshing to see younger brothers and sisters learn from his insights. Brothers, sisters, comrades, the party may be no more, but we are all still here, older, wiser, battered, a little bruised, but still in our own ways, in service and in struggle to our people. The struggle continues. We must do our best to pass it on. I thank you all. On the move, all power to the people. From Death Row, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Prison Radio.
Yes, indeed, and that is prisonradio.org. Once you got the archives and all the different essays that Mumia puts out over the years. And his case is up for appeal. I'm not sure if you know the fact. He did put out an appeal in February, I believe. And they had to dot some I's and cross some T's. And I believe it was last month it was officially put in. So I think before the end of the year, they're going to have a date set for the retrial of Mumia Abu-Jamal. My goodness. And for the brothers in the Nation of Islam, you know, first of all, us in Portland, we get the AM radio nice and easy. AM radio 1480, Reverend Al Sharpton every day, Michael Eric Dyson every day. Shows that people on lockdown in Salem, I'm pretty sure. Well, I shouldn't say that, but I do not know if they're on in Salem or Ontario or Hood River. But just to let you know, for the brothers who haven't got to add the word, that Minister Louis Farrakhan is ailing. This is a news report. Quote, Minister Louis Farrakhan is ailing and in seclusion in his Michigan home, and he has ceded leadership of the Nation of Islam to an executive board while he recovers, saying the movement must prove that it is more than the charisma, eloquence, and personality of just one person. In a letter written September 11th, 73-year-old Farrakhan, he's 73 years old, y'all, looks good, 73-year-old Farrakhan wrote to his followers that he was anemic and 20 pounds lighter because of complications from an ulcer in the anal area. He had surgery in 2000 for prostate cancer. Quote, In this period of testing, you can prove to the world that the Nation of Islam is more than the charisma, eloquence, and personality of Louis Farrakhan, he wrote. You can prove that the Nation of Islam is more than the physical presence of any individual, and that it will live long after I and we have gone. And September 24th, just about a week ago, Reverend Jesse Jackson visited with Louis Farrakhan by phone, and the minister had who spoke with Farrakhan, and he said that the minister had given up oversight of the nation, quote, because he wants to devote his time exclusively to physical restitution. So those of y'all with the nation and anybody else who want to send out some prayers and some love and just some hopes for Minister Louis Farrakhan, that's his current condition right now. And he had some members of the nation on Reverend Al's show yesterday speaking about it, and he said he has good days and he has bad days, so y'all pray for him. Okay, this weekend there was a march in Salem, one of the few that I participated in briskly, wholeheartedly. And what the case was, and the reason we were marching, it was black and brown together. Yes, black and brown together. It was in Salem. Half of the march was about, forgive me, I do not know the law, the immigration law, HR, immigration law that's being put out now, that there's all the turmoil is about the immigration law. We had the brown folks for that in the march. And on the other half, African-American folks, black folks, we were down there for the Daryl Skywalker case. The Daryl Skywalker case, for those of you not familiar with the case, Daryl Skywalker was in a club in Eugene, 2005. It was Daryl Skywalker, African-American black man, and two of his white partners. And on the other side of the club was three white guys all together. One of the three white guys called, one of the white guys was Walker, called him a wigger. And if you know what a wigger is a white N-word, white dude trying to act N. So a fight ensued, and we feel very bad about the young man had fell and hit his head and passed away in the fight. A man died in the fight. But of all six people, only one person was charged. Only one person got 5.5-6 years in jail. You know it, the brother, Daryl Skywalker, with witnesses that said that Daryl Walker did not hit the man. It was not Daryl Walker who hit the man that fell and hit his head. And the prosecutor or the DA, I'm forgetting exactly who it was, could not locate said people, said persons who said that they did not see him hit him. But it was kind of funny how the Salem chapter of the NAACP, excuse me, the Eugene chapter of the NAACP located him within 4 hours. But that was after the case. So the appeal process is in session. We had a march. We marched from Riverfront Park in Salem over to the state capitol. And at the capitol, we had speeches put on by NAACP members from Los Angeles, Eugene, Salem, Seattle. Also on the brown side, the immigration law side, we had a couple of Hispanic folks, powerful folks, and they put it down also. And I wish I could tell you exactly where on the web right now. It's on the web, on YouTube, that YouTube thing. Go to YouTube and search for the march, Daryl Skywalker. You should be able to find that march and video online about it. That's a little bit of what's happening so far. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Reggie Bob. We'll be right back because we're putting it down for you here on KBOO Radio. Volunteers, y'all. That's what we do. Volunteer. city, lots of things going on in the world. Prison, Portland, Oregon, all over the place. If you're on lockdown, big up, stay strong. All of you, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, hey. And if you're in there, make this the last time, if at all possible, make this the last time that you're on that side. A couple of birthdays to let you know. Yeah, yeah, big up, see? We give big props. Birthdays today. Check this out. Talib Kweli's birthday today. Brothers, you know Talib Kweli? He's 31 years old today. Who else? Reverend Al Sharpton. Big up, big voice, powerful man, putting it down for many years. They say he's been preaching at 4 years old, ordained at 9. Preacher, Reverend Al Sharpton's birthday today. He's 52 years old. And later on this month, Michael Eric Dyson's coming in. And on the TV side of things, if you got your VCR, you might want to break that out. If you were lucky enough last night, you caught it right on time. We're talking about, yes, indeed, we're talking about the Eyes on the Prize. Eyes on the Prize series. I think it was made in 1990-something. And what it is about the Civil Rights Movement from 1954 to 1985 is the whole thing. I'm not sure how many parts they have, but right now they're showing part one from 1954 to 1956, including the Montgomery bus boycott and the Voting Rights Act. And it was on last night from 10 to 11 on Channel 10 in Portland, OPB. But if you got your VCR going, if you're up late night tonight, 3 o'clock, they're going to show it again. 3 o'clock tonight, part one, Eyes on the Prize. And don't get mad that they show it again that late at night. There's so many things on television. But hey, you know, it's good that they're showing it again. And if you know how to work that machine, you can do it. You can get it. All right? We're talking just like that. Okay, like I said, our sister Ruth is out. She's doing good things out there. And I have a CD here that I'm not yet prepared to play it because takes a few minutes to get it all together. But what this CD here is, a group of inmates in Ohio, the Ohio State Prison, put together a CD called Wings of Hope. Wings of Hope. And I do believe they were serious when they put this together. But what it is, it's a CD of children's stories. All the Pretty Little Horses, Little Bird, Hip Hop, Hokey Pokey, telling you the truth, This Old Man. So I'm going to preview this CD, and next week I'll play a little bit of it. Hopefully it's a serious thing, and or not. I'm going to try to get the real story behind it all. A sports station actually played some of this, so I got a hold of it. My copy now, I'll review it and be back with you next week on this thing here. Okay, it's Prison Pipeline. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm your host, Reggie Bob. This is Community Radio, KBOO. Do you know how many youths in jail? How many black men? This is what an inmate told me. Let it be the Most High's will to have me where I am. Let them see that they can't kill the inner part of man. Even though the cell is locked and they've thrown away the key, I'm the finest of the Father's crop. I deserve to be happy. I'm just saying, down, somebody's down in the concrete jail. Right there, that's Niora. That's Niora singing about the concrete jail cell. He was in town a couple of weeks ago. Big up Ross Danny and Posse getting Niora to come to town and put down some sounds like that. Concrete jail cell. And the Western Prison Project is an organization that's been in Portland for years and years, for at least the past 6 years. And oh my gosh, it looks like they might have changed their names. So we're going to check that out a little bit later. But they have a couple of news projects I want to let you know a little bit about. And they said right now in the United States there's more than 500,000 women that are incarcerated. The United States is the world leader. The country imprisons 1/3 of the over 500,000 women incarcerated around the world. 183,000 of them in the U.S. Other countries that top the list: China has 71,000 women in jail. Russia has 55,000. So there's some information, a little bit of information there. This prison, Western Prison Project X website, or not, this one is called Safety and Justice, the Partnership for Safety and Justice, and it has Western Prison Project stories on it here. So that's the kind of things that are going on, trying to keep track of things. Also, if you're a voter or not, October the 17th is the deadline for voting, getting registered to vote October 17th. And I'm going to have a special on August the 12th, I believe, August the 12th, next Thursday, to talk about that. And next Tuesday on Prison Pipeline, I'm going to talk about voting or not being able to vote as a ex-offender. And lots of states, most of the states, make it a lifetime ban on being able to vote in that state. Whereas other states, you still can vote. You can get your right to vote back after a number of things. So we are going to be looking into that because elections is next month, November 7th, I believe. So, hey, if you're going to vote, you haven't registered yet, and if you just think you got registered and you think you're all good, you might check it out, because so many times people go to vote, find out that their precinct has moved, and they don't get a ballot in the mail. So many things. So, hey, keep up with your electionism. People died for our right to vote. They died for your right to vote. If you can vote, get your vote out there. Okay, just a couple of ticks away. And I just want to let you know that, hey, we are feeling for you out there. Feeling for you out there. Big up to all y'all that have been released lately. Also, next week, we're going to try to have a parole supervisor on the show. Got to get the okay from a number of people. You just can't get a guest come on the show talk about parole. Isn't there a parole officer, parole supervisor? So we're going through the steps to get that person on the show next week. It looks like it's a go, but still we got to make sure that we do everything just right so we can make it all good. And hey, it's getting close to the end of the show. If you have any subjects you want us to check into, any cases you want us to look at, if at all possible, not saying we can do anything, but hey, we can take a look at it. Don't forget, looking for brand new DVDs or brand new VHS tapes. Uhuru Sasa is looking for. You can send a gift down to OSP with that. They're looking for tapes and DVDs about African culture, educational, even old classics. But the things you cannot have, they cannot have anything in there about rape or prison escapes, and we can understand all of that. So, there's also, in recapping, Brother RB down there in OSP, he was stating he would like to have a prison pal, a letter writer, a pen pal, and he did some internet radioing. It's a pirate, a little bit of pirate radio, and he's also very interested in getting on the radio, doing some radio activity, radio activism when he gets out. So he's looking for somebody to write him. And if you want any of these things to donate, your time or effort, just email me, reggaebob, like it sounds, reggaebob at comcast.net. Also, don't forget, Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, not doing too good these days, brother. Stay strong with that, because the end might, it really might be near. So be prepared for that, and hopefully folks take that in stride, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I'll be back Thursday with the Good Time Show, 7 o'clock, and be back next Tuesday with Prison Pipeline with a couple of guests. This KBO Radio, Community Radio, it's the station where almost nobody gets paid down here. We do it because we like to help the community and do what we do. Thank you for listening. Back Thursday and back next Tuesday. Stay strong.
'Cause most of them are black. Down, somebody's down in the concrete, yes, yeah, now your rock gives a damn. I'm not forgetting anyone. Love will be deep within always. How can I have faith no more? Judging me on a 1-10 scale, way over 20.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.